Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. And you know as well as I do that this program airs locally at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. and 1 a.m. Then Monday morning. 7 a.m. and p.m. are on Sunday. Sunday, 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Monday morning at 1 a.m. we are podcasting these programs. Or actually, I guess we are placing these podcasts. Not sure the term how that goes. I'll have to check with an English professor on that one. Anyway, we do have podcasts. They are available at SoundCloud, at iTunes, at Stitcher. I think that's the name of the place. Also at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page. We also link to our guests' website so that you can go and get more information, because that's what we want you to do. We want you to investigate, to research. We want you to evolve. I'm evolving, and evolution is nothing more than change. But I heard someone say to me not long ago, you shouldn't use the word change. I thought, well, that's odd. Why shouldn't I use the word change? Because change implies it could be changed back. You might think about using the word transform. Because usually, for example, a caterpillar doesn't change into a butterfly because it can't change back. It transforms. So, evolutionary transformation, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. And we're going on a trip, folks. We're going on a trip. We're taking a little trip. It's called a gifted journey, and it has to do with five, oh my goodness, what do you think of that? Five transformative steps to uncovering your unique path with my special guest, Stephanie Moore. Thank you so much for joining us on the program.
I love that intro. You're welcome.
You know, it's interesting too, because there are different definitions of, shall we say, a gifted journey. From my perspective, the way I would look at it, I consider myself to be a very fortunate individual. I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth, or gold, or pewter, or whatever. Grew up in, and I'm very proud of the fact that I grew up in a wonderful household, a family, middle class, middle America, so to speak, in the heart of Phoenix, Arizona, and was well cared for, loved and cared for by my parents and my siblings and relatives alike. And it wasn't quite Norman Rockwell, but it certainly wasn't the dysfunctional families you see and hear about in movies and television around Thanksgiving and Christmas dinner, where you end up having a food fight or a knife fight, depending upon the severity of the dysfunction, right? But I consider myself, and I've used this phrase before, I've always felt as though in my career in particular, but in other areas of my life, I've always been at the right place at the right time. There are moments, though, I'm sure you felt this too, but I've also had those moments when I'm thinking, what am I doing here, and why am I still here? And why I feel stuck, and it's like, what's going on? And so then I have to do some, you know, self-analysis and evaluation and so forth. Well, we're going to kind of do that through the work that you have provided for us through this wonderful little book called The Gifted Journey. And we're going to dive into this in just a moment. But we first have to quite actually ask the ultimate question, even though it doesn't start. Your book doesn't start there. I'm going to start there. One of the key quantum questions of the universe that we've been asking of ourselves ever since man's been on the planet. Mm-hmm. Who am I?
Yeah.
Help me. Help me, please. Let's start there.
Okay.
So how do we answer that question? Where do we go to get the accurate, correct, true information that tells us who we are?
So it's interesting that you start there, because I think that was the catalyst for this book, was that in the 30 years I've been doing career development, even before it was a thing to do, there was always these questions that kept coming up for people and at different times in their life. And I found that it was mostly at transition times where people were really stopping and asking that big question, who am I? And, you know, over the years, you start to say, I wish I had a crystal ball to help you But I do know that over the years working with lots of people, that there's a way in which you can approach this that can start to help you uncover what that might be. So I think, you know, as we outline in the book, it really is, I think, at the very first step, taking time to ask that question. And I think that it was spot on when you said, you know, it is a question that gets asked a lot. And I think I've also met a number of people who maybe later in life are just now starting to ask that question. So I think it meets you wherever you are. And that first step is really to take that time to discover what has been going on in your life. Where have the themes been popping up? What are you learning in those moments? What seems to keep arising for you as you are experiencing life? And to then help you to inform, what does that mean going forward?
Well, I know that there are a lot of people who give all kinds of answers to that question. One of my favorites, when I was conversing with one of my guests some months ago, and I bring up the question, you know, as you heard me mention about how we're evolving, you know, we're in an evolutionary process, regardless of your belief system. If you don't believe in evolution, it believes in you, because that's what you're doing. That's the process that happens when you go to school. That's why we're sent to school, to learn, to evolve. Evolve is change, transformation, as I look at it. So I asked the question this way. I said, looking into your crystal ball, you know, where do you see us going? What is it are we going to, in our process of evolution, we're going to get to the point where we're eventually going to know who we are? And they said no. And I thought, really? Wow. He says, no. What we're going to do is we're going to evolve to the point where we're going to know who we have always been.
Exactly.
I thought that was an incredible answer. Yeah. And I guess when we ask that first question, who am I? Right. That's a very individualistic question and answer. But when we're talking about the species of man, who is man? Or what has man, or the human being, what has he or she always been? Do you have an answer for that, or do you have a speculation?
So you're asking, who has man always been?
Yeah.
I mean, I think, again, the comment that was made, I actually use the idea that at some point we are going to come back to who we always were meant to be. And I think that, you know, we are always in search of why we were created the way we were. Why do we have this ability to be reflective and to, you know, consider, you know, who we are? I think just as you say, it's going to be an evolutionary thing, and we continue in search of. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that process is going to be different for everyone.
Mm. Absolutely. I mean, we're all different. We all learn differently. We all eat different things, drink different things, take on different careers, et cetera, et cetera. And yet we're all part of the same family.
Right.
And as such, we need to kind of work together. I want to jump into one of the steps here that when I found this in the book, I like that, because it reminds me of a scene from a movie going back to the, I think it's the 90s. Forgive me for going back so far. But it's actually a scene where the movie is City Slickers. And I believe it was the three gentlemen are riding, and they're chatting away, nice little conversation. And all of a sudden the question comes up, you know, what was your... You know, they started talking about bad days. They talked about the bad things that have happened to him. One guy who's been divorced once or twice, and then this and that and the other. He says, okay, yeah, but what was your best day? And I remember that had to have been early 90s, because I hadn't had my best day yet. But it came along in 1993, the September of 93. I was on a camping trip with some buddies. And I got into an altercation with one of them. He and I had driven up, without going into a lot of the detail, we'd set up camp in a very haphazard way. And he kept telling me how to do things. Back then, I was 33 at the time. And I knew how to wash dishes. I knew how to stack wood and start a fire. And it's not with gasoline. I want you to know. I'm not kidding you. That is how we started the fire. And he says, okay, here's the match. Light it and then run past and drop it. And I'm glad I did. In any event, we had a little altercation. I went up the hill and because I was like, hey, you're not my dad. You're not my professor. I know what I'm doing. And, of course, we kind of patched things up. But later in the trip, I was all by myself. And I had helped him refurbish this boat, patch a hole in the bottom of it with fiberglass and so forth in my garage. Mm-hmm. I said, you know what? I'm all by myself. I'm literally stuck. I have no vehicle. So I'm going to go over to the lake. I'm putting that boat in the water and I'm going to row back and forth, whatever it takes just to have some. And I did. And I was great. Went back to the campsite. I lit this big fire just for one hot dog. I got the camp all situated. And then the other buddy shows up and he's got this big pot with this huge bone-in ham, and we got the pork and beans and we got this thing going. And then of course the beer and the Jim Beam, I guess it was, or whatever it was. And we had the greatest evening, just the two of us. This was my other buddy, a friend of mine, and I. Mm-hmm. And I looked back on that very shortly after. I mean, like the week after I'd come home, and I realized that was my best day.
Mm.
Because I had achieved something that Robert Bly had talked about in his book, Iron John, about that moment. They talk about the moment of catabasis, which really wasn't mine. It was like reaching the bottom.
Yeah.
But it was, I had stood up for myself to this one, to the one fellow who was older than me, much older than me, professor and so on and so forth. I didn't hit him or anything. I didn't wound him, at least physically, supposedly emotionally, because he was a Vietnam vet and supposedly I brought up some PTSD stuff. But anyway, and I just look at that day and go, wow. And I remember sharing that with my mother saying, yeah, I think that was the day I became a man. Mm. Well, I was 33 at the time. My mother's response, and she's always been loving to me, but she made the comment to me, she says, well, it's about time. That's in step one of discovery. What role does the best day and the worst day play in one's life of discovery?
Well, you know, I think, again, you have to look at those times in your life where you felt energized, where you felt like you were coming into yourself in many ways, where you felt a sense of satisfaction and a sense of confidence, and you get this feeling that, you know, maybe you can't even put words to it, but it's where you feel alive. And so it's being able to go back and reflect on those moments. And the exercise in the book is your best day. And really, it's meant to be more of a mental imagery of what was I doing? Who was I with? What activities was I engaged in? And then the second step is then to put words to that, to put descriptive words to that, because that's where we get those glimmers of, wow, this is really tapping into who I am. And I really want to see how I can manifest that into what I do going forward, how I can bring those elements in to my path forward.
Well, I know that we've talked on this program a lot about self-discovery, that's critical. And it not just self-discovery, but the willingness, the openness, the honesty that one must use to look at who we are, both our dark and light sides, right?
Yes, absolutely. And that's why I mentioned the kaleidoscope analogy, because for me, it's like when you look through a kaleidoscope, you see all these pieces that form these patterns. And those patterns are really the themes that keep coming up in your past. And it depends on if you point it to the light or to the dark, right? If it's a good experience, it's going to feel light. If it's a bad experience, it's going to be dark. But these themes keep occurring. And if we take the time to really look at those and then go into the second step, which is really to discern, to evaluate objectively what that means to you, it can really make for a powerful you know, path as you start thinking about what you want to do going forward.
I remember Veterans Day 1999. I was producing the morning show for a gentleman by the name of Austin Hill. He's since passed away. He's a young guy, too, I remember. So he wasn't much older than me. So I'm like, uh-oh. But I remember the PD had said to us in a meeting prior to the show days earlier, we were planning on this. We were going to have all kinds of dignitaries calling in, and he was going to interview congressmen and senators and war heroes and all this kind of stuff. And we want to make Austin human. What we want to bring out the emotion in Austin. Austin was a very intelligent man. I mean, just as sharp as a whip. I kid you not. And so we get in there at 6 a.m. and we start the show, and the show ends at 10, 4 hours later. And that day, it was flawless. I have to tell you. And I still have, I actually have the CD of the entire 4 hours. And my boss, the PD, comes into the control room, stands in front of me, puts his hand out, shakes my hand, and he says, 4 stars. That was like the Oscars for me. Another one of those best days. Okay. Now, yeah. one of my worst days, May 1st of 1998, a year earlier, when I was served with divorce papers at work, you know, not a great day. And certainly there have been, you know, obviously those ups and downs, but it's the acknowledgement and acceptance, isn't it, of all of who we are, because who we are at this moment is a result of both all of those good and bad days, right?
Absolutely. Well, and that's, again, why we say, you know, as you do the reflection, you want to be in a space where you can do it objectively and with compassion and understanding. You know, it's not just about wallowing in the past. In fact, there are people who would say, don't look at your past. I think you have to be able to go back and say, I need to discern between what really brings me to life and where I have felt maybe even the lowest, just because it's going to help going forward.
Yeah. I like some of the this list that you have here as far as looking through a list of possible activities and so forth and checking them off, like solving complex problems, building relationships, creating spreadsheets, leading small groups, resolving conflict. Oh, there's one I would love to, because there are some conflicts I'd like to just flat out resolve, put both parties into separate corners and say, and you won't come out until you've, you know, it's like a parent telling, you're going to your room and you think about what you've done. You know? working on creative projects, selling ideas or solutions, getting things done and so forth. And it seems to me like self-evaluation does seem to be a difficult thing for a lot of folks to do, because they, in addition to making the list, then they start. And to me, here's the trap. I'd like to expound on this. They get caught up in judgment of self over these.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why even throughout the book, we talk about it's very hard to do this in a vacuum, because we tend to be self-critical, right? We tend to devalue some of our experiences, and it could be out of humility. It could be out of just maybe childhood experiences that somehow we evaluate, and why we need an outside perspective, people who know us well, to be able to affirm some of these areas. And so you're absolutely right. We tend to be really hard on ourselves or discount the value of what we've experienced. So it's getting people to not only look at this for them, but to get other people to help inform some of that.
When I was, go ahead.
No, that was that. Yeah.
I was going to say that when working for the Christian radio station back in the 80s, early 90s, I came to the, to sort of an epiphany that God, in whatever form we choose to acknowledge, already knows everything about me, the good, the bad, and the ugly, okay? There's a movie in there somewhere. that if 7.6 billion people, which is what's on the planet now, If all 7.6 billion people knew all of the good, the bad, and the ugly of my life, so what? God already knows. And besides, the majority of the 7.6 don't care. They just don't care. However, if it shows up in the tabloids, a few more are going to care, but I don't know why. So I just came to the point where I say, you know what? So what if I talk about, oh, I have high blood pressure. Oh, I had glaucoma, lost vision in one eye. Oh, no. And then, of course, the good days, the best days and that kind of stuff. I think that that's one of the problems that we struggle with in not only the self-judgment of by ourselves, but the fear of being judged by others. Because we experience the same emotions, but for a lot of different, the stories are a little different, but the emotions are all the same.
That's right. That's right. I would agree with that. And that's why you need those trusted people in your life, and why part of this process is really to seek those people out, to be intentional about who you surround yourself with, whose judgments you care about and you trust, because it really is. You know, and I want to just comment, you know, again, this idea that God knows who we are. You know, God created us in these amazing individuals that we are, and we spend our lifetime trying to go back to that unconditional love of being created. And I think, you know, that's kind of the emptiness in our souls a lot of times, is wanting to get back to that, knowing our truest self and being that best version of ourselves. And so it's a hard process, and you have to get to a point of self-acceptance and expand beyond that. And that's why creating this group of people that can surround you and support you and encourage you is so incredibly important in this process.
And this is part of step two, actually, discern.
Yes.
I take that back. Step three. Let me get this in the right order here. No, it is step two. I jumped to step three. My mistake there. Step two is just that, is to discern. And I've often said to people, you know, that you have the freedom. I use the word discrimination, but I don't mean it in the context that is used today. I mean that we get to discriminate in terms of the people we associate with, based upon whether or not they are, at the very least, not demeaning who we are and where we're at and our dreams and hopes and desires and so forth, and not passing judgment. And also saying, you know, I want to surround myself not with a bunch of yes people, because I think that's important that we have some people who call us on our stuff. There's nothing wrong with that, which is far different than people passing judgment.
Right.
Also surrounding ourselves with people who support us, who encourage us. Hey, keep going. Don't stop now. You're almost to the top of the hill, kind of stuff.
Exactly. Well, you know, I equate it to, you know, I've been a speech coach for many, many years. And part of that process is that people get videotaped. And if they've never seen themselves on video, that self-critic comes right up, right? They just know they're going to look terrible. And in fact, when you sit with them and you watch that video with them, the first thing they'll notice is how much, how heavy they look on camera, or what they wore that day, or what's wrong with their hair. My job as their coach is to say, whoa, let's take a step back, look at it from an objective perspective, and let's look at it as the audience sees you, and let's look at what's working, because there's this balance, you know, there are always things we can improve, but we also have to take time to appreciate what's working in our lives. And especially in that environment, you know, let's look at what you are doing well before we start to pile on with everything we need to fix. So it's true for our life, right? We need that objective perspective, somebody who's going to give us that balanced feedback to say, here's what's working. Here are some things you need to think about.
You know, I participated in an interview program down in Los Angeles a few years back. A friend of mine, a good friend of mine, who he and I produced 12 programs for the year 2014 on mythology. And so he said, hey, come down to L.A., take the train down, come down to L.A., come to the studio. We're going to have it all set up to where we're going to interview this gentleman who is affiliated with the Joseph Campbell Foundation and the Ojai Foundation just east of Santa Barbara. And we're going to sit, we're going to have just one of the programs, the Myth of Sophia programs, a part of Tell Me Your Story. I said, sure, great. Come down there, you know, hat and a blue shirt and the whole thing, you know. Videotaped it. He sent me the video and I've got it up on my website. I have to tell you, it's really interesting when I looked at it, because I was struck by how fluid I was in that interview. And again, I'm starting to cross some lines here, because it's like, okay, how do I talk about this without sounding overly egotistical?
Right.
You know, that kind of thing.
I know exactly what you mean.
But I looked at it going, I like the way that I look. I like my hand gestures that are part of the you know, in a video works great, but here on this radio program, as I wave my hands around, nobody knows that I'm doing that. Can't see it. But I was really impressed by the fact that somebody had told me 10 years ago, you really ought to be doing television. And I'm going, maybe they're right. Maybe I need to make that transition. Although I don't know how well they're going to do the lighting with me wearing my hat as opposed to my bald head. But I was just struck, and I, again, trying to be as objective as I could be, kind of hard to do that with oneself, but nonetheless going, yeah, I can see myself doing that and having a lot of fun doing it and still coming across with, so Stephanie, tell me about the work that you're doing these days. And off we go into our conversation.
Yeah.
Now, how does one, what kind of, is there a phrase that one might use, a mantra or something, or a mindset that we need to get into when we begin that process of evaluating ourselves, both the good and the bad, the light and the dark, so that we don't, you know, we don't overinflate ourselves, or we don't beat ourselves down, you know, when we see those things that just, you know, oh my God, I'm so heavy and I'm this and I'm that. And so is there a technique that you're aware of that we might use to help us to do that?
You know, what comes to mind is the idea of being like a scientist, right? You're going into a laboratory and the thing that you're going to be, you know, looking at is yourself. And so you do it from a fact-based objective perspective, for instance. And so you want to be out there gathering data, really looking at it, evaluating it, deciding whether it's useful or not, and go into this with that intention that I'm only going to put so much weight on each of these because it's really in my past and I'm using it to inform my future. You know, another great way is to think about, you know, when you're moving from one home to another, you know, people don't bring everything with them into their new home. They take time to really assess and discern, do I really need this going into my new space? Does it mean something to me? Is it going to give me joy? And if not, I'm going to leave it behind. You know, it's just going to be something I now kind of pack away, and I'm going to take the things that are meaningful to me moving forward. So it's going into it, yeah, with a very objective perspective and use it as a researcher as you would gathering facts.
Stephanie Moore is my guest. The Gifted Journey is the title of the book. It's also the website URL, if you will, or address, thegiftedjourney.com. We encourage you to go there. We encourage you to continue to research and investigate. And before we go to break, folks, I'm going to leave you with this little teaser here. May you have the wisdom to enter generously into your own unease, to discover the new direction your longing wants you to take. We'll find out what that's a part of in just a moment here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay with us.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
And welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. And we do that on, as I've said before, Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. Podcasts are at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page, SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher. We're going to expand that as well so that more folks can find out about us, listen to the programs. Go to our guest's website. In this case today, it's thegiftedjourney.com, and find out more about not only Stephanie Moore, beyond what we're going to find out about her here in the rest of the program, but also about the book, The Gifted Journey, and we encourage you to help us out with that. Now, the next step has to do with the very thing that I mentioned about choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. That is step three, and the quote that I read was from John O'Donohue from I guess, the poem For Longing. And the first section in this particular chapter of your book, chapter four, but step three is imagine the possibilities.
Yeah.
Now,
yes.
Yeah. Tell us about, you know, I mean, what are the possibilities? I mean, there only have to be what, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 possibilities?
If it were so easy. Well, you know, it's really something we learn to do as children, right? When you were young, my guess is you probably imagined yourself doing a lot of different things. I chuckle because my son, when he was around 4, you know, I had just read the book. In fact, Barbara Shear was coming into this whole arena of career development, self-development, and she had written a book called Wishcraft, W-I-S-H, craft. And she talked about when kids are young, that they are told early on that they can't necessarily be what they want to be or that they need to get real. And she talks about when kids are little, and an adult will say, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? And the child tells you, and you're like, oh, you know what? If everyone could be that, there'd be a million people doing that. You better think about something that's going to sustain you. You know, as a little kid, we get censored a lot, you know? And I remember coming home telling my husband, no matter what our youngest wants to be, we're going to support him. And we're just going to support the dream because that's what we need to do so he gets comfortable dreaming. And the first thing he wanted to do was be a garbage collector. And I remember asking him, what was it about that was intriguing? And he loved just watching these big trucks come and pick up these cans, and he was so fascinated. So every Tuesday morning at 6 o'clock, he'd be there watching, you know, them come and do that. And then as he got older, his dreams changed to wanting to be an artist. And then he got on stage and decided he wanted to be an actor. But I realized that the process of dreaming is difficult for a lot of people. This idea of just letting your brain really expand and not put limits or boundaries on it. And it gets harder and harder the older we get with all the pressure and stress that's placed on top of us. And so this idea of going back to that childhood experience of just letting your mind expand and create these imageries in your mind, even if they don't exist, because what's interesting is if you do this enough, it really can almost become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Your brain tends to open up to new ideas, and things are put on your path that you never even thought existed. So that's really kind of the essence of that whole dream stage.
And it's extremely important. I've used this, I've described this many, many times on this program, a public service announcement that ran, and I want to say 15, 20 years ago. Opening scene is of a little boy, and he's playing out in the yard in the dirt with his trucks, his little Tonka trucks. And then the next scene is an adult wearing a tie, a long sleeve white shirt or blue shirt, whatever, wearing a hard hat. He's holding a set of plans spread out in front of him, and he's talking to these guys who in the background are building a house or building something. They're in the construction field. Next scene is a little girl, and she's got her dolls, and she's playing, and she's got this little stethoscope and a little popsicle stick as a tongue depressor and so forth. Next scene is, here you have a woman who is taking care of someone, say, in the ER or what have you. And what it was saying to me was, fulfill the dream, your childhood dreams.
Yeah.
That's where your passion lies. That's most likely where your life's purpose is. Because as children, we already know. But as you just, I think, quite eloquently said, we start to lose that as we start to grow up.
It is so true. You know, and here's another thing is that you've got a lot of people out there that want to discount, you know, those experiences. I remember my first job out of college as a sales rep for the phone company, and I talk about it in the book, you know, going in to that week of sales training that they put us through. And I still to this day remember the woman. She was wearing this bright red suit and she was driving a red Mercedes. And I don't know why that caught my attention, but I later found out she was our sales trainer. And it was amazing to watch her lead us through this week of sales training because she was passionate about what she was doing. And I watched her and it was like this spark lit up inside of me of that's a career I would really enjoy. And at the time I didn't even know what that was. And so I remember going to my boss at the time saying, you know, that was a great experience. I'd love to know at some point how to get into the training field. And immediately she came back with, oh, you don't want to do that. I've done it. Oh, it's horrible. You have to travel and you know, it's exhausting. And by the way, you aren't even experienced to do it. So I think you're better off just doing what you're doing. And I remember feeling really just deflated. And it wasn't until a couple of years later, I finally got a manager who said, Stephanie, what do you really, really want to do with your life? And I remember, it was almost like I went right back to that moment where I shared it with the other manager. And I almost didn't tell her because I felt like if I share this one more time and somebody, you know, deflates it, I'll probably never share it again. But she encouraged me and she said, no, I really, really want to know. And I told her and she said, well, then we need to get you on that path. We need to get you in front of people. And she made me the ambassador for the company. So I went to trade shows and I did all that. But it was like somebody had just put oxygen to this little spark. And it just fueled. And I knew in that moment I was on the right path. I knew that this was where I was always meant to be. And if it wasn't for that manager asking that question, I mean, I say I owe my life to her today.
You know, it's interesting the people who we have come across in our lives who we would probably say the same thing about. And I owe mine to a lot of people, at least not the least of which are my parents, yes. Who are in their mid-late 80s now. And I have to say they aren't parents anymore. They're just really good friends, which is really kind of cool.
That's very cool.
And then there are all the people I've come across throughout my career. My very first general manager who always, she shared something with me that has stayed with me ever since. And I've shared this with everybody I've trained who gets really nervous and scared about what they're doing, you know. And I say, this is not brain surgery.
Right.
Okay. This is not brain surgery. I can guarantee you that right now. So whenever there's a mistake, you need to ask yourself a few questions. One is, did anybody die? Well, as far as the work you're doing, nobody died. Okay. Did we go off the air? Well, if we did for a couple of seconds and now we're back on, well, we're good. Okay. We will move on. We go on from here and so forth. But one of the things she said to me once when I got really nervous once, she says, okay, I noticed that you're feeling like you want to panic. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to hold on to that panic, but hold off getting into it. And I want you to resolve the situation. And then when the situation's over, you can go over into the corner of the control room and you can puddle right there. You can panic and puddle right there. In other words, she wasn't saying don't panic. She was just saying you're going to get to panic, but I want you to resolve the situation first. Then you can go panic. And when you think about that, it's going, well, yeah, but if the problem's resolved, why do I need to go panic? And which was her point. Yeah. You don't need to panic. You need to resolve this, turn that energy around in the other direction.
Yeah.
In terms of the process of creating a map for one's future, for those dreams, go where you are celebrated, not merely tolerated.
Mm-hmm.
I was working at a radio station for, I want to say, 9 months. And when I was hired through the sales department, and I was not, nor am I, a an, you know, I do not have the education or experience as a salesman, a salesperson, okay, in the sales force. And yet that's where I was hired, because he was hiring me to replace the program director at that station, who was still working there. So when I was hired, the program director knew exactly what was going on. He and I got along really well. When they did let him go, he was still there to help me and assist me through the process, even if it was on the phone. And for those first couple of 3 months, I was like the general manager's best friend. I could do no wrong. But after that 3 month, shall we say, honeymoon wore off, it was as if I had just killed his best friend. And it was the most hostile work environment I have ever worked in my life. To the point where I was cowering in the production room. I would go into the production room and do production and stay there as long as I could so I wouldn't have to deal with the GM and his toxicity.
Wow.
Now, certainly I could have done a lot of other things, but I was so headstrong, I was not going to give him the satisfaction of quitting. So at the end of 9 months, they laid me off and gave me a severance package. In broadcasting, unless you have a contract, they don't give you a severance package, unless in this case, they knew they had done me wrong.
Right.
But I was then hired by another station literally a few weeks, a week or two after that, and it was like I had walked into a family. Open arms. They had no clue as to what I had come from. Friendly, courteous, every bit the helpful people. I mean, it was like night and day. You know, it was fantastic. Another one of those best days, I guess you might say. And then this was right around the time of that Veterans Day program that I produced. They decided to sell the station. And I'm thinking, I'm going to be the first to go, because I was the first. I was the last one hired.
Right.
I made the cut. And in January, they did the same thing. They were cutting more people, and I made the cut. And by the time March rolled around, there were only one or two people left working there, and I was virtually running the radio station by myself, almost. Then I didn't make the cut with the PD. We were both let go. But I was called back 2 weeks later to run the radio station, because the gentleman that was there at the time was moving on to Colorado. So I was given the opportunity to literally run a radio station all by myself. But it was in an environment that was so, everybody should be working in an environment like this.
Right.
Or in a relationship or in a family. Right. You know, we're not talking Pollyanna here, because, hey, we had our disagreements in my family. We had our struggles and fights, but we worked them out. My parents taught us how to do that.
Right.
You know, and you don't stay mad. You know, you're siblings. And in a manner of speaking, you and I, Stephanie, and everybody that's listening, we're siblings for one another, because we're all in the same family, in the same community.
Right.
So how do we go through the process, having had those kind of experiences and not wanting to regurgitate the self-fulfilling prophecies that we have been so ingrained in us?
Right.
How do we rewrite those so that we can have new prophecies fulfilled that are wonderful and expansive? Or you use the example of oxygen on a spark. Yeah, that's explosive.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. You know, as I was listening to your story, it brought me right back to the values exercise, right? So it's important to know who you are. And part of that is knowing what you value, not only for yourself, but for the environment that you're working in, for the type of relationships you want to be involved in. I think that one exercise in the discover step is so incredibly important, because just like you experienced, you know now the difference between a toxic environment and a loving, caring relationship, which is my guess is going to be, it's going to be at the very top of your list of values of things that you need in order for that oxygen to create that combustion. And so, you know, when you get to the design step, you bring all of that information in. You go back and you say, I want to make sure that as I'm doing my exploration and I'm connecting with others and I'm making you know, these inroads, I want to make sure that that those are the questions I need to be asking, is what kind of environment is this like, you know? And I think you start to formulate that ability to really get specific about what you need in order to really be bringing out the best of you. And so I think somewhere you connected into that, and why you weren't some of the first rounds of layoffs is because they felt that connection. You were bringing specific value and energy and passion and enthusiasm for what you were doing. And really, you can't manufacture that. You have to, when you see it, you know it, and you hold on to it.
I was fortunate too. I still consider him my best friend through grade school, high school, and college. And we used to go to the first station I ever worked for, which was a radio reading service for the blind and visually impaired. And as a side note, I've taken the oral reading test for them 5 times. Wow. Now, I've been in this business for almost 40 years. 40 years this year.
Wow.
I haven't passed that oral reading test yet, okay? So I'm not sure if this career is going anywhere. Okay, this could end everything right there. But I have to tell you that we used to go in there late at night with a stack of records, and his favorite thing was Circus Peanuts, and we'd have sodas and all kinds of snacks, and we might bring another one of his friends in. They'd be in the studio, I'd be in the control room manning everything, records and tapes and all this kind of stuff, and we would play radio. Just play. Now, we weren't on the air. We weren't broadcasting over the signal. We were just having, and we would record it. And I found those tapes, and I'm trying to get them digitized so that I can send those to him, because I know he'd get a kick out of them. We just had a blast. And one of the things that you talk about, you use the word path. We use the word purpose. Same thing, exactly the same thing. We talk about that in very strong terms on this program, that you need, you, the listener, need to find your life's purpose. Now I'm going to guess though, Stephanie, that your life's purpose today may not be your life's purpose tomorrow. It could change, transition, transform, transmute, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And that if you were to back it out a little bit, saying, okay, it's not necessarily interviewing, it's not necessarily production, it's not necessarily this or that or the other, back out just a little bit. Maybe it's to be, in whatever form that takes, of service to people.
Absolutely.
Talk to us about the path.
Well, I think, you know, again, as we go through these 5 steps, that last chapter is all about a deeper longing. I think at some point, when we get that confidence, we're making inroads on this path, we're starting to get involved in things that bring us meaning and purpose, we do start asking the deeper questions from being to serving. You know, it's all about being able to think, how can I now give what I've been given as a gift to others? You know, and this actually came from more of my spiritual gifts experience, because that was the question I was asking myself as I was doing more and more career development. You know, we tend to be inward focused and navel gazing and really trying to figure this all out for ourselves. And then as we start to get that confidence and we start feeling like we're on the right path, inevitably people will come back and go, okay, now what? Now, how do I really turn from self to serve, right? And be intentional about where I spend my time and energy in service of others. And when I went to my church and said, you know, how can we help people really get to that point where they really feel themselves able to do that? There was a workshop that was just being rolled out called Called and Gifted, and it was all about this idea of spiritual gifts, the gifts given to us, you know, by God in order to serve. You know, the gift is given for others. And so it brought this whole idea of career development to a whole nother level. And I really resonated with it. And that's why the book is actually called The Gifted Journey, because it comes from that gifted, you know, being involved in that. So I think we do. We start asking those deeper questions, and then we start looking at how do all my skills and my talents turn into these gifts I'm now giving to others.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned that because I think I flashed on the passage from the New Testament where it talks about Jesus is talking to his disciples and he's performing these miracles, and they're going, wow, that's pretty cool. Hey, Master, can we do that kind of stuff too? You know, show us how, show us the magic, show us the trick. You know, we won't tell anybody. And his response, basically, and I paraphrase here, is, "Hey, this is nothing. Yeah, you guys can do this, but you know what? You guys are going to do greater works than this." And to me, what you are talking about, you, Stephanie, are talking about, are those greater gifts of transforming our lives.
Right. That's exactly right. You know, and I think it was interesting because I'll just share one quick story. When we started rolling out the Gifted program, there, you know, I thought we would have lots and lots of people coming to these workshops. And I found that that wasn't necessarily the case. And I asked one gentleman, I said, "How come you're not coming to the called and gifted?" And he said, "Oh, no, I don't want to go there because I know what you're going to tell me. You're going to enlighten me so that I have to leave my family and my children and move to India and become Mother Teresa." I looked at him, I said, "You've got to be kidding." He goes, "Oh, I know. I don't want to know. It was like ignorance is bliss. And I know that there's something very special, but I'm not ready to hear it. And I don't feel worthy." And a funny story is we did get him to eventually go through it. And one of the charisms, one of the spiritual gifts, is writing. And I sat down with him afterwards and I said, "So what did you think?" And tears running down his face, he said, "I knew this is what was going to happen." And he pointed to the word writing. And I said, "Well, why is that so upsetting to you?" He said, "Well, you know, when you write Christmas cards and you write a letter to people," he said, "mine is always spiritually based." I said, "Well, that sounds great. What's wrong with that?" He goes, "No, you don't understand. A week later, I start getting phone calls, my phone rings off the hook, people saying that my letters bring them back to God." And he goes, "That has always scared me, the power of whatever they're reading in my letters. It's not my intention." So it was, he knew there was something in him that was so powerful and it scared him so much. And long story short, we ended up I did a few interviews with him, got him into a small group. And he ended up being a ghostwriter for a children's author on how to bring children to God. And it was the most amazing. And he didn't have to leave his family and he didn't move to India. So he was able to really, I mean, find that deeper meaning and that path that he felt he was always meant to be, but was scared to go there.
You know, that's really, really interesting because it ties into a subject again. We talk about a lot of stuff on this show.
That's why our past trust.
and one of those things is the power of words.
Yes.
And somehow he was tapping into that higher self, if you will, of himself when he shared those words in those letters. And I can understand why that would scare him, because I was around for 15 years, these kinds of people who were trying to convert people.
Yeah.
And when I met individuals face to face in studio, wonderful people, beautiful people, it was those who were distant, who had these huge ministries, who were regional or national or international. Those were the ones that scared me. Because I can certainly appreciate his trepidation in wanting to go any further, and why, you know, that brought him to here is because he's thinking, "I've got this power and I don't want to abuse it. So rather than risk abusing it, I won't use it."
Yes. And not only that, I'll bury it and never talk about it. And yeah. And deny it. I mean, that's the sad part, is the denying of it. You know, I don't want to face it, so therefore I'm not going to give it any credence.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I tell you, it's a remarkable journey that we can go on going through. We're going to go through Stephanie's fifth dimension, folks. The five D's, if you will, in regards to these five steps. Then I encourage you to pick up a copy of the book, which is called The Gifted Journey. Now, by the way, I was reading something here that because I'd be very interested in working with you on this because I could use a little upper arm strength. You're a strength coach, right? You work on muscles and, you know, building us up. And but you're a Gallup certified strength coach as well as you've also 20 years ago. Well, actually, it'll be 21 as of this broadcast. 21 years ago, you founded the Moore Group. You also co-founded the nonprofit Catholic Strengths and Engagement Community. That was back in 2008. That was 11 years ago. I mean, you've been a busy woman, and I'm curious not only as to all of that and how that obviously works into what we've been talking about today, in addition to the workshops that you hold, the Gifted Journey process, but how your family has, how your family sees you these days with all of this wonderful work that you're doing to help people.
It's so funny you asked that question because my oldest son, both of my sons have been instrumental in my journey. I have always believed they were here to teach me, not the other way around. And it has held true over all of these years. My youngest was the one that encouraged me to even write this book. He said, because 5 years ago when I started it, I was looking at my bookshelf and seeing thousands of books of, you know, similar type, and everyone wants to write on self-development. And I'm thinking, what could I add to this process? And he said to me, do it because you can. And if you don't, no one else will. And it really hit me, you know, that's kind of the essence of this, is that we all have a story to share. You know, we all have a journey that we uniquely are experiencing. And if this just touches one person, then it was worth the journey to do it, you know? So he is my wise old soul. And my second son is this amazing energy, just wants to help the world, wants to find his path. And he just recently quit his job as a senior manager at a very well-known large restaurant chain to come work for the Moore Group and to be a part of this process. He just went and also was trained as a strengths coach. So his passion is really going to be to help others, you know, find their purpose. And so I couldn't be more proud or excited. And my husband has been just a number one supporter. He just has said, go do you know, you got this. And he's just been there every step of the way.
Those are the kinds of people you want in your corner, in your circle, and having your six, as they say, because, you know, it's hard to do it alone. A lot of people, they end up having to do it alone initially because there's nobody there that will support them. But eventually they start drawing to them. That whole law of attraction starts to kick in, and they start drawing to them the people that will assist them through that process. And you certainly have that in your own family. But I'm also certain that you've also drawn to you some pretty remarkable people to this the Gifted Journey project as well and process. I have to tell you that we need more like you. We need to. Would you be adverse to being cloned?
No, but I wouldn't make the comment about the people are so important to be open to it. You know, at some point in my life, I would say it was probably about 10 years ago, that I was starting to get this real momentum about what I wanted to do. And then the book idea came, and I've learned now to not say no. I've learned that when people come onto my path, I feel like they're there for purpose and reason. And I learned that from my spiritual director, Fran, who I mentioned in here. She has been with me every step of this way. And even when the path wasn't clear, she'd be, okay, what are you working on now? What are you going to do next? And she's just been there. And having those people, my sister, my brother, you know, the people who just surround you and just are always encouraging and supportive, I don't take that for granted at all. I constantly let them know what they have meant to me, and hopefully I return it in some way to them. But you're right. You just have to acknowledge and appreciate those people who want to be there walking alongside you.
Yeah.
For sure.
And I know too that and I've had these feelings myself of wanting to be accomplished of my own, you know, by my own hands, if you will. Yeah. You know, I want to be able to look at that and say, I did that. And yet I can say that, yes, I've had those moments, but then I have to stop and say, yeah, I did, but I didn't do it by myself. And again, right. I take a look at the last 40 years. I take a look at the people who have been in my life over that period of time, the influence they've given me, the education and so forth. And it's like, okay, it's wonderful to say as an individual. I still remember during one, I don't know if it was a presidential campaign or it was just midterms or something, but there was a group in Texas and throughout the Midwest that just going on and on about how I did this, you know, the business community, the entrepreneurs, I did this by myself. And I'm watching these news pieces going, no, you didn't.
Right.
Because if you could do it by yourself, you wouldn't need customers. You wouldn't need a bank. You wouldn't need anybody else. You would be self-employed. You'd be independently wealthy and so on and so on and so on. But even then, you couldn't do it because the building had to have been built by other people and the products you're selling had to be constructed and manufactured by other people. We don't do it by ourselves. Yeah.
I was just going to say, you know, acknowledging that we don't live in isolation. We live in community. And I have grown to really appreciate that I would not be anywhere I am today were it not for the community that I am a part of. And we all support one another. And so, again, that's why I say the path now is just for me one of keep going down that path and acknowledge every single person that is there who you come into contact with because they're there for a reason, such as yourself.
Yeah. I want to ask you also really quickly here. You have plenty of time to answer this question, I hope, but what role does your faith play in all of this?
It's everything. And that's a short answer. But and it also gets me a little emotional, but yeah, it's everything. I left the church for many years. I didn't lose my faith. And I came back to the church because of my son wanting to know God. And I said, if I'm going back, I am not going to be a passive bystander. I want to be active. I want to understand it. I want to understand what it can do for my relationship with Christ and with God. And it's why I ended up going to the School for Pastoral Ministry, because I couldn't answer a lot of questions. And I don't know that I left that 3-year program having that many more answers, but that it gave me a deeper sense of that relationship. And so while I didn't, you know, make this a religious book, I wanted it to have a feel of spirituality. And I wanted to reach as many people as possible who may have had no exposure to faith, or, you know, I want it to be something that really does connect people to their deeper self, which hopefully will lead them on a journey to opening up to a deeper experience in their life and then ultimately to a faith.
I told my mother at 16 when I delivered newspapers and it was Sunday morning newspapers, I'd come home and I'd go to bed. She'd say, okay, time to get up and get ready for Mass. I don't want to go, Mom. Okay, all right. And it was years later that I asked her, I said, why did you do that? And she said, because I didn't want you to push away from the church. Now, I'm not a practicing Catholic, but I didn't leave the church. But I still have a great love for it. I love the ceremony, the ritual, the tradition. I was even privileged when I was married to my first wife to be a part of the Byzantine Rite of the Catholic Church.
Oh, very cool.
I even have a hardcover of the liturgy, which is the same week after week after week. And even though obviously the homilies change and obviously the songs will change, But there's something about it that is, draws me back. And maybe I'm one of those now that is in that category of, okay, you're hatched, you're matched, and you're dispatched. And then some holidays thrown in there too. But I think too that we have something else in common too. I have this feeling inside, I've had it for years, that my life has meaning. And I'm not buying into this, this is just an accident. Because if this is just an accident, then following this interview, it doesn't matter if I go out and rape and pillage and plunder, because my life has no meaning. But there's something inside that says, it does, so I don't. I don't do that other. And we're here talking about all this great stuff, and I encourage folks to continue their transformational evolutionary process. Stephanie Moore, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the program. This has just been absolutely fantastic. I do have three final questions for you before we let you go, but I want to remind our listeners about The Gifted Journey, thegiftedjourney.com, 5 transformative steps to uncovering your unique path. And you can basically enter the fifth dimension with Stephanie by getting a copy. By the way, I want to share with you real quickly that I was interviewing a physicist who wrote a book about the fifth dimension. And he shared with me, he says, I can prove to you the existence of the first, second, and third dimensions, height, width, depth. I cannot prove the existence of the fourth, but I can show you the effects of the fourth, which he defined as time. Then he began to describe the fifth dimension. I won't get into here. To which I said, and we were walking back from lunch, and I stopped him, and I says, you do realize that the description of the fifth dimension, and again, coming from you, a physicist, a scientist, the description you just gave, there's only one word I can use, God. Yeah. And he just looked at me and said, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this has just been a great lot of fun, and I thank you so much for joining us on the program, and I hope many people will go to your website through our link or go straight there through thegiftedjourney.com. Final three questions for you, and by the way, should you find yourself in the Santa Barbara area, I know you're from Northern California, but if you're down here in Central California on the Central Coast, we would love to have you in studio to continue this conversation.
I would love that. It's my favorite place in the world there.
First question. Oh, and you're going to love this question.
Okay.
Who is Stephanie Moore?
Oh, wow.
That's where we started.
Yeah, that's a good question. Stephanie Moore is a person who has traveled a long journey. And became just enthralled in this idea of helping people live their truest self and figure out who they are. And it's been a theme that continues to emerge in every aspect of my life. And it's been this ongoing quest. And it's brought me to this point today where I have as much passion for it today as I did 30 years ago.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
Exactly that. I hope that anyone who chooses to come onto this path for however long or short walks away with a deeper sense of self and a deeper sense of their purpose and their path. And, you know, if that can happen, that would be the ultimate.
And to that end, what is your life's purpose?
I'm hoping that I will continue to discover that, you know, as I'm doing this, I know where I find my joy and satisfaction. And that is really, again, reaching out and helping people with this process. So I hope to continue to evolve that. I hope that we are able to touch as many people as we can and in a significant way. And that would be the ultimate.
Stephanie Moore, I want to thank you again for joining us on the program, and I do look forward to having you back on later in the year. And Happy New Year to you. We've got 2019 right ahead of us here, and I think that this would be a great way to start the new year.
Thank you so much, Richard. You made this an amazing process. You definitely are gifted.
Well, thank you very much, as are you. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal and Makushla.